and welcome to the 19th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Jesse Gitzman-Burke. With me tonight are Lich Light Troubadour. Is that how you say that?
Yeah, that would be precisely how you say that.
Lester Crow and his strolling bones, and our special guest, Layla Fridge Gargoyle Miranova.
Hello.
Fridge Gargoyle, that's the best handle I've heard in years.
Thank you.
Codan and Fridge Gargoyle, awesome.
I even think there's a picture to go with Fridge Gargoyle.
There is a picture.
Sweet.
We may have to talk you into sharing that one.
It was so long ago.
So many of you guys may know Layla. She plays Helga in our Witch's Song episodes and a few other preceding sessions to that one. She also recently GM'd for the first time, so we're going to get the opportunity to talk a little bit through how a new player approaches GMing for the first time, also how to approach the Warhammer world for a first time, and also a female's perspective for playing Warhammer. So that'll be one of our main topics.
Exciting.
We've also got a boatload of questions over the last 2 weeks, which is really exciting. Probably even too many to go through this episode, even though we are going to dedicate a little bit of extra time to it. But I think we're going to be able to get through quite a few. But Lester, some of the biggest news these last 2 weeks is the introduction of the Heroes Call supplement. Yeah, you're a happy boy on that one, huh?
Very happy.
So tell us a little bit about it. This is something a lot of people have been asking for probably the better part of a year now.
Oh, easily. Yeah. From what I understand is it's like the first high-level supplement where they're introducing a fourth and fifth rank. That's pretty high level considering how easy you're supposed to be able to die in this game. But I'm assuming that they're going to be doing things like, wizard masters and like battle wizards and things like that.
The components outside of just introducing some epic level stuff, they did go in a little bit of what's actually going to get included. They said there would be 12 new careers, talent cards. There would be human-specific regional locations. So you can have somebody from, like, Midland or Nuln.
Well, they just
not
said
just Reichland.
They said 12 regional options for men and dwarves from outside
right.
the Reichland.
So we're not only going to see the Grey Mountain dwarves from Karak Asgaraz. We're also going to see, perhaps, the World's Edge Mountain dwarves, the Black Mountain dwarves. And that's probably going to be it. It's probably just going to be those three options, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get Chaos Dwarfs.
But we will likely see the 9 Empire regions.
Do you think they'll do 9 Empire regions, or do you think they'll do more like North and South, and then that leaves them the opportunity?
I think we're probably going to see all of them. We'll probably see Kislev. We'll probably see Nuln.
You don't think they'll do Bretonnia and Talay and Estalia, even though they've introduced characters in the actual
So those
characters?
Are interesting ones. The forums are really alive with that right now on what are these careers going to be. But before we get into that, let's quickly dabble on one of the more exciting bits of news that's coming with this is that they're also introducing 2 new races.
They thwarted me. No.
So I think it's pretty safe to say the halflings are coming in this supplement.
Yeah.
But the big question is, what's the other one? Because there is no one that's really just jumping out saying, get included.
Ogres makes the most sense according to like the fluff and the way that ogres are represented and how they do exist in the Empire and how in the Battles game you could play them in your like as Dogs of War and stuff like that. So that makes the most amount of sense. Plus they just released the Ogre Kingdoms book with the Battles game and all that.
So that would be a very appropriate tie-in from a kind of cross-media perspective. There's a lot of doubt, though, that the ogres are actually the second race from what I've gathered on the forums. And I'm still a little skeptical, even though that does seem a safe option. It also, you kind of have the big and the small kind of juxtaposition thing to go to market with. I'm thinking the alternatives that people have thrown around are offering Bretonnia as a separate race, given that they have such different fluff and different style and locations.
But they're just humans, though.
Progression. They are just humans, right. But, they don't go through the normal Empire career progression. Instead, they're going to do something more like Grail Knights, Knights of the Realm,
But that just comes down to careers. I wouldn't say that that's going to make them a whole separate race, though.
Yeah.
I just can't see it. I can't see that.
People have also thrown out the ideas of lizard men.
No,
which
I can't see that. They're cold. They're not intelligent men. They just do what they're told.
You know, maybe they're going to go the Warhammer Online route and make Skaven a playable race.
That would be awesome.
That would be the worst thing to happen ever.
That would be the greatest thing ever. Oh, that's all I'd ever play would be a Skaven.
What's the big deal with the halflings? Like, why is everybody so excited?
Because they're short and fat and, I don't know, people like hobbits, I guess. I don't know.
I don't quite get it either, to be perfectly honest. I played a halfling once for a session or two.
Yeah.
I think they're kind of
the quickest. It's the hairy feet, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the quintessential thieves, if somebody kind of wants somebody who not only has a profession as a thief, maybe is in its blood.
Yeah, they're all about excess, and they're pretty resilient against chaos as well. Like, they don't get corrupted as easy in like a physical sense, but they definitely like their drink and they like to steal and stuff like that. So
they're very integrated into the Empire society as cooks or servants or. Yes,
isn't one of them an Elector Count even?
Oh, is it? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Moot has its own Elector Count, which is a halfling.
Oh, that'd be cool. Well, I think it's very safe to say that the halflings are in, and the other one, I'm leaning like 60% towards ogres. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a better alternative unless they actually choose to make a race of man count as a new race, given that they're actually a completely different culture, like Astalia, Talia, or Bretonnia.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's still unlikely.
I still think that will be left to regional options.
I did have one other idea, which I broached on the forums, and I haven't even checked to see if anybody's responded to it yet. Oh, did you? So I was thinking, and this is really kind of a pie-in-the-sky option, but and some of the later supplements in second edition, they had begun to offer once one of your characters turns to chaos, you can continue playing them just as an evil character. So I was wondering if this kind of chaos tainted or turned character could be considered with a new set of rules another race.
I don't know if they do it like as a race, though.
You don't think they'd count as a race?
No, but I think they're building up to it. Like once they release the Slaanesh box set, it makes sense to make it so that you could play evil campaigns because there's enough cards for the evil characters and stuff that you could totally play as a bad guy.
Well, I mean, Helga is already over halfway towards becoming a Chaos Spawn. So.
That's why I was wondering about it. I was wondering if even after I grow like a third boob or something, if I could just keep on playing with her.
Well, I think the life as a mutant is something I'm very excited to try at some point one of the characters, is forced to live with their mutation and try and hide it.
Yeah,
until eventually they're on the run or just so disheveled that they can't even continue and you have to roll up a new character and they become an NPC. I'm kind of excited to see where that comes.
I think that makes them I don't think you need to worry about growing the third boob so much as you do totally losing your mind to chaos and becoming a gibbering spawn. Or you're just like a slavering,
Gain an insanity just by gaining a mutation?
I don't know, actually.
I can't remember if that was from the second edition now or the third edition, but I'm certainly encouraged that. I know you gain a boatload of stress.
I mean, I'm sure the third boob will have like fangs or something.
I can't wait for the Slaanesh mutation deck because there's going to be some really interesting things in there.
Yeah, second.
We might have to mark this intro here as explicit.
Oh, yeah, whoops, sorry.
So other parts that were introduced or mentioned in the teaser that were really interesting is that Archaon, who is the Lord of the End of Times, he's kind of the guy who's brought all the chaos powers together and launched a huge invasion down into the Empire. Now, the fact that they're even including him in this is really cementing the fact that
it's coming.
His invasion into the Empire is going to be the major focus of where this third edition storyline kind of continues going forward. Now, those of you guys who also play the tabletop games will know that this whole Archaon invasion is something that has already happened. Actually happened
In the mid
2000s. I want to say about 6, maybe even 8 years ago in the tabletop games. That was actually like at the height of when I was with Games Workshop. So I'm pretty familiar with that whole thing. We played out all those campaigns throughout the stores.
Yep.
So it's actually really interesting having the role play setting actually kind of be not in the same time frame that the tabletop setting is in.
Well, the second edition one kind of, it kind of took place after that, I do believe, or like kind of during or after that. I like how they rolled it back though, because it's so rich. That's such a rich period in the Warhammer, like time, you know, time frames. How many awesome adventures can you have set with this massive invasion of chaos coming? I think it's brilliant personally.
Well, that also means then that there will probably be some kind of large culminating battle at Talibheim. And there was a couple other really big ones too, which off the top of my head I forget.
Well, they'll probably make a campaign supplement that is a big adventure slash campaign based.
Yeah, I'm thinking that they, that one that everyone's kind of expecting to come at some point, the big campaign, is going to center around Archeon's invasion.
And that'll probably be the next thing that they announce. It's just, that's just a speculation, but that's what I would say.
That makes sense to me. If not the the High Elves or Wood Elves, we'll see some love.
One thing I was really interested in too is they kind of like teased one of the cards here, one of the new abilities, and it's a rank 4 Amethyst Order spell called the Caress of a Lamp. And I really liked how in the top left corner there, where you add the challenges to your attempt or whatever, how they actually have challenges and banes built right in. So you automatically, as soon as you try to do it, you have to overcome one challenge and one bane.
At that point, that really shouldn't be a problem. Your wizard's going to be rocking off
You should be
some
pretty
serious
hard.
Spells at that point.
Should be pretty hardcore for sure.
So some of the other news, there's been a lot of generation of new character sheets on the forums recently. There's about 3 or 4 people who have been trying to redesign or make a more efficient or more fluff-filled version. So I threw my 2 cents in there and came up with one too. So there's a lot of great ones out there, but definitely check out the forums. I've got mine, which is the first half of the character sheet. It's called Gitzman's character sheet. It's on Gitzman's Gallery. But basically the idea I went with it is that I wanted to make it super easy for new players to be able to generate their dice pools and also have everything you need to play the game in front of you on one sheet. So you don't need really anything else. There's all your bookkeeping, your post-game write-ups and experience and everything like that. It's not on the first page. It's going to be on the second page. So really, you don't need to turn anything back and over. You have color coding. It should be very visually help aid you in playing the game. It even has all the basic action cards on your character sheet.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular. There's a couple other ones, too, that are very fantastic. Yours is definitely really visually appealing because of the color, and it's all, you know.
I think mine's probably not going to suit the people who really want that completionist or kind of, like, loads of detail approach.
I would say yours
There's some other ones that fit that better.
Yeah, but I think if you yours want that is minimalist better And Sorry, yours is better. I was just going to say, I think yours is better for new players because, like you said, it's really helpful in just that visual aid. You look at it and you know exactly where the dice are coming from.
And well, it is still a work in progress. So if anybody has any feedback, I'd love to hear it and I'll do my best to incorporate it. And I will do my best once it's finalized to make it form fillable, just like the other ones.
Exciting.
So Witch's Song, which Helga's part of, and
I'm
really
looking forward to,
and very begrudgingly following the dwarves.
Right.
We're going to do the finale episode of that this coming week. So within the next 5 or 6 days, we've been having some fun with that one. Have you enjoyed that one so far?
You know, I've liked parts of it, and other parts of it I'm still having some trouble with. I'm having trouble with mostly, like, the motivational aspect of it, because I'm not really sure why Helga is motivated to do anything at this point. So I've been struggling with that, but I enjoy the pigeons. Those are fun.
Lester, she brings up a good point. What do you do to build motivation in your character? How important is motivation for your character? So I find some gamers really are just cool taking the story for as it is and playing it, while other people really need something more to to hang on to.
Well, I like narrative a lot, and I think that's one of the beautiful things about role-playing games. So I do personally think that it is important to have that oomph or that drive, because if you can't figure out why your character would be doing something, I could definitely understand and sympathize that it's very difficult to make decisions, because you're like, well, why is my Kislevite goat herder going through all this?
I still laugh when I hear it.
Trying to slay monsters that she obviously can't slay.
Yeah, precisely.
Like, why?
Precisely. Like, well, then run away, And I think that the onus at that point falls on the game master to maybe manipulate the story so that it adds elements to help motivate specific character types.
Mm-hmm. I'm finding Helga particularly difficult to motivate.
She's a little difficult, it's true. I mean, part of it too is I'm still kind of learning just the whole Warhammer world in general, and how how all the different parts of it work, all the different, what do you call them, races?
Sure.
Yeah. So kind of as I learn more about that, I'm thinking she might find some motivation somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to develop her backstory for myself. Maybe that'll lead me to some motivation. But right now I'm with three dwarves who don't listen to me. And it's kind of hard to play with them because I don't feel like I'm playing with them. I feel like they're just playing and I'm just there.
Yeah, see, that can be frustrating too, especially when you get that sense as a player, like in the metagame where you're stepping out of just your character and you feel like, well, maybe, because sometimes people are like that where they, a player will use something metagame to, almost use it against other people they're playing with, and that can really drag games down. I don't think that that's the case from listening to the sessions, but.
Well, I think from the GM's perspective in this group is we have a variety of experience levels of players. We have some people who are brand new to role playing, some people who are brand new to Warhammer, and some people who are total veterans. Now, To add some complication to that, we also have three of the four players playing dwarves, and the last one is a human. Not only a human, it's a female human. So you have this
a female human who's supposed to be very charming and vivacious, and the dwarves just don't respond to that.
And you're also from you're also a peasant, from what I understand, right? Your character is a commoner, which doesn't really jibe very well with dwarves, who are all very greedy bastards, right?
And I think the dwarves are, unfortunately, the dwarves are actually playing it appropriately, I think, which is kind of the problem.
Helga's having an identity crisis.
Yeah, maybe you should try to act more dwarfish. No, I don't know.
You did take him to the bar the other day.
I did. I've gotten drunk.
So I think inherently just the dwarves are playing their characters stubbornly, and that frustration is being felt on many, many levels. But at the same time, it's really staying pretty true to, and almost comical at times, where the dwarves are like, well, let's go into the swamp and slay stuff and find gold. And Helga's like, dude, why?
Yeah, like, what am I doing here? Yeah, I can understand that.
But then she reluctantly ends up going and following and trying to keep them out of trouble.
Well, what's interesting at that point, too, is I wonder, like, what if I decide to stay behind? At that point, what's the GM going to do with me?
Yeah, it's true. It makes it hard. Like, it's really difficult when you have to juggle two. Like, if you ever split the party up in a game, it's very
hard. And I do my best to never allow that unless it's absolutely necessary, because it just drags everybody down. Nobody likes to sit and wait 20 minutes to play.
Well, that's why Jenny and I are actually planning on running a game where we both game master so that we can.
That is the only time I've seen it succeed.
Yeah,
and I had a blast when they did it. You had two guys game mastering, and once they split up, each game master went with each group.
Exactly, and I like the dynamic of having a male and a female, because then the female can fill all the female roles, and the male can fill all the male roles, and it makes it a little more believable. You know, like when I'm trying to be, if I'm trying to be Helga, I wouldn't know what to do. Like, ha ha ha.
Well, you can't be a wench, is that what you're saying?
Well, I could be, but
only on the third Thursday of each month.
I'd be really bad at it,
Well, so the witch's song.
Your eyelids pretty.
I got
he is a 7 foot tall, voluptuous Canadian.
I'm very not voluptuous. That's where the lich-like thing comes in. I'm extremely slender and the bones.
You're gaunt. Yeah. So the last bit of news for this week is the updated components list, and Living Index / Errata is back to life.
Which is crazy. Because I brought this up probably about a month ago on the forums. I'm like, so what about the Living Index? Do you think it's dead? And everyone was during the time where everybody was worried, and they're like, woe is us, this game is dead. And I didn't believe that because, well, for one, I was doing some freelance work for Fantasy Flight Games, and I was pretty convinced by the way they were talking, some of the guys were talking, that it's fine. Like, the game's definitely being developed well and being taken care of. But I brought that up, and then it just came out of the blue. I'm like, wow, they finally did this. And I think that gives us a lot of hope for at least another year worth of support for the game.
I think you're definitely right on the money. I mean, just the fact that they've given this high-level content supplement mm-hmm. really lays the groundwork and foundation for at least another 6 to 9 months of foreseeable content before they give us another teaser. Because they did mention that the Heroes Call was going to be coming out in the first quarter of 2012. So we really know we're only getting two pieces of content between now and, let's call it, April.
Well, I don't know. I would say more of like, I'm going to say February, because I believe that the Slaanesh set will probably come out early November or to late November. And then I think another couple
months. I seem to recall hearing something about October, but I could be wrong.
But it very well could be. I'm not an optimist. So I'm going to say sometime in November, maybe for the Christmas push or whatever. But I believe it's actually going to be really early for the Heroes Call in the year, because I believe around April we should be seeing another supplement or maybe an adventure based on high level stuff.
Well, all they said was quarter one. Oh, speaking of adventure, there is supposed to be an adventure in that supplement, Heroes Call, as well.
Oh, really?
They didn't really say that it was going to be big and grand, so I'm kind of guessing, giving the quantity of other content that's coming in that box, it's probably not going to be a super big adventure, but it will be a high level adventure.
Yeah, one thing I noticed too, a lot of people were concerned. They're like, well, my players will never make it to rank 4 or rank 5. But I think that they're overlooking the fact that if you really wanted to play, if your players want to play a high level campaign, you can always create characters who are of high level, you know?
Because Helga's right now kind of pushing 11 or 12 experience points.
Yeah. Ooh.
So you're already like, you're into your first or your second rank.
She's just about to transition, and we're kind of like working that into the story now.
Right.
Well, she's got some interesting ideas.
Perfect for your motivation, because you could create a character who you might be able to find more motivation in.
So do you want to talk a little bit about the origin story that you put up on the forums?
I wrote a little origin story for Helga. And I think where it took me was this kind of hatred for witch hunters. And her entire family has been killed off by witch hunters at this point. So she's both wondering why her family is targeted and also wondering why nobody will stand up to the witch hunters. So she's kind of going to take it upon herself to do this and learn some hedge magic in the process. So she's headed to Altdorf.
That was all preceding the adventures that we had done, the Blackfire Pass, and she's been through the Grunwald Law, the Eye for an Eye campaign, and a few others. So she's been around the block a few times now. All right, so we're going to take a quick break here. When we get back, we're going to talk with the Fridge Gargoyle here about a GMing experience where you took on the Winds of Magic adventure at PacificCon a few months ago. And we're back. So we're going to talk to the Fridge Gargoyle about the Winds of Change adventure that we ran at PacificCon. And that was about 2 months ago. So at that point, you played in about 3, maybe 4 sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And those were your first role-playing experiences, both with Warhammer and with role-playing in general. Mm-hmm. So what really made you want to jump in and try GMing a game?
I really liked the idea of being able to control the players and kind of set out a story. So I thought I'd give it a try. That was basically it, really.
We just out of curiosity wanted to jump in, and I really appreciated how you just kind of said, hey, I'm just going to do it. And you grabbed the book, you read through it.
Well, yeah, I had played, obviously, with Jesse and seen him do it a couple times, and I thought it looked doable. So I have to say, though, like, I underestimated what it took, because I think you really do make it look easy. Because it wasn't so difficult that I wouldn't try it again, but there were definitely some challenges.
So given your first attempt, I'd love to hear your perspective, because you're coming to Warhammer fresh, and I have my own personal pet peeves of how they've organized the books and how they present the information. How, now you're fresh, this is your only experience with it, so you're kind of given this is how it's done. So how do you feel the information was organized and presented to be usable for you to actually run it?
I didn't think it was particularly good in terms of being able to use the organization to set up the story and run everybody through it, because it's organized into sections, and every section has all these details and descriptions. And I found myself mostly juggling all of that in my head instead of going from one section to the next as the characters walk through one section to the next. I would have preferred that.
You'd have preferred it to be more linear as opposed to separate.
Very much so, yeah.
Okay.
That's a tough thing to do, especially when you have often there'll be a series of locations and a series of characters which mm-hmm. are at each location, but throughout the story, those characters might move to different locations, and there's really no way of determining where the PCs might be at any given time and what order they'll visit those locations. So it, I feel your pain in that, because that seems to happen a lot in all these adventures, where a lot of them are very non-linear, and you're really forced to kind of have this wealth of knowledge and juggle it all at once.
Like, I almost felt like it would have been helpful if the book says something like, if the players go here, then present the following information. If the players, turn this way, then present the following information.
Kind of like
have
a choose
it laid
your own
out
adventure.
That way. What?
Kind of like they'll choose your own adventure books.
Yeah, kind of.
That would be nice. They do that occasionally, but I think the one of the fun things that a GM is forced to do is to actually generate some of the content from the book, and then the other content you just gotta make it up on the go. Mm-hmm. And then as you're making it up on the go, you're rapidly in your mind saying, how the hell do I reconnect this back to something that's written?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the end of the session, I had ended up making up most of what was happening, so I pretty much derailed myself.
So how do you think the game went? I mean, you played it with two PCs, myself and somebody else who was relatively new to the game.
I mean, I thought it went well. Would you say it went okay?
Yeah, I had a great time, actually. I think you handled it well in the... I could tell where you struggled, and Dave and I did our best to kind of pick up the slack or to bring the story back together. But I think it actually shined the most when you allowed it to derail and just kind of went with it. The flow became a whole lot better.
My biggest regret was that so many characters got left out. I just didn't get a chance to get the characters to see those NPCs, and so I wish that I had had an opportunity to do that. We got to the battle scene pretty quickly.
Well, how much time did you have to prepare for it?
I mean, I had read some of it ahead of time, and then I sort of finished the rest of it kind of like on the spot, so I didn't know the ending until basically like we were about to play a couple of minutes later. But I was like, well, whatever, I'll wing it. And yeah,
that works for some GMs very well. Some GMs like to like that more open-ended kind of approach to it. But I find that if it is something that you struggle with or something you find is a problem, like how you liked it to be linear, I think the best bet is to know your stuff beforehand. Like, that's how I have to approach it, or else I suffer from that where I leave a bunch of stuff out and I feel almost like I'm rushed or something like that.
Yeah, totally. Since then, I'm thinking, if I GM again, I will kind of draw out the different scenarios and like list the characters in each scene. And I think that would help me a lot. So I want to try that.
Cause you could create your own instances of, well, if the PCs decide to do this, well, then I can present them with, you know, this or this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It comes with, I'm a total, like when it comes to GMing for me, I'm totally all about preparation and being prepared. I'm not very good at improvising.
Mm-hmm.
So so it sounds like you read the adventure once.
Mm-hmm.
Lester, how many times do you read an adventure before you actually get down to running it?
I like to read it thoroughly through one time before I actually run it, and then I like to actually take pieces out of it, like we were saying, and break them down and change them to suit my style and my game and my player's style. So I'd say I probably work with the adventure for a while, but I would say I spend at least a couple days working with the adventure. Like if it's a short adventure like the one you were running, The Winds of Change, I would probably spend a couple days working on it before I ran it with somebody.
What I usually do, and I find I've kind of honed this more recently, is that I find reading the adventure once gets me nowhere. I'm in no shape whatsoever to run it. If I'm lucky, I know what the heck happened. But once I read it the second time, it all starts sinking in. So what I do in that second read is actually grab a highlighter and highlight the content in the adventure that is player safe to read or for me to read to the players. And that allows me to differentiate, you know, what can I read to them? What do I need to keep to myself as we're flowing through the book? And it pretty much in itself creates like a cliff notes of the adventure. And that makes flowing through it much, much easier as you're when you're actually playing it, because they'll use that as your notes and you know everything that's highlighted is safe to say.
Okay, that's actually a great idea.
Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, my biggest complaint from other books, other role-playing game systems, is they would very traditionally say, when the players enter this location, you read the following to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm really missing that from most of the Warhammer books in this edition.
Yeah, they do so it, but very rarely, hey? It's very, very seldom. Like
1 in 10, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm making them by just highlighting stuff that's safe to say. Because they have great descriptions. They just don't tell you. They intermix in the same paragraph things that are great for PCs to hear, but are also things that are critical for them not to hear.
Yeah, that's what I like to do as a preparation, is like, I guess I would just approach it in a different way. I like to make notes about what is safe to say and maybe even write my own descriptions up. And I like to kind of have almost like a brainstorm of the possibilities. So I don't know, that just comes down, like, different game masters run games different. I know a couple that are very good at, they won't even read the adventure, you know, they'll get a few of the plot points down and then just run it from the seat of their pants, and however it goes, that's the way it goes, you know?
Definitely. Well, I often find that when the game derails or crazy stuff happens, tends to be some of the most memorable.
Mm.
But it's also can be some of the most frustrating or anxiety causing for a GM, especially a new one. So, Layla, was there anything that really stood out as hard or unexpected in the game that we ran?
It was really hard juggling what the NPCs were supposed to know and present. And keep to themselves. I guess we were kind of talking a little bit about that. I didn't think it would be so difficult because I read through and I was like, okay, you know, this is the halfling's deal and, you know, okay, like I'll compartmentalize that. And this is, you know, the guy in the squares deal. And, you know, as the characters approach each, I'll know what to say. But that didn't actually end up being the case, because they would approach and suddenly I'd be like, well, I don't know what to do with you, really. So that was much, much harder than I thought it would be.
I find that to be a big problem on my end, too, where, okay, I have this roster of stuff internally I want to convey to you, but generally speaking, PCs walk up to an NPC and smile and look stupid mm-hmm. and to say, and are waiting for something to happen. Like, they don't often engage that NPC with a roster of poignant questions like they should. Right. That's probably more on the shoulders of the PCs to really become better investigators and learn how to talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've kind of begun to recognize that as a problem in myself or something I want to improve on. I think that generally speaking is a problem with many, many groups out there. So PCs, a wag of the finger to you, talk more.
Yeah, and like actually dig into the story a lot more. But it also depends where in the story you're at. Like, if it's early on, then I think it does fall on the GM to provide information to the PCs. But once the adventure starts to roll out more and the PCs are in possession of a lot of information, then they definitely should be prying more and asking more questions and using the information that they've gathered, you know, to move the story along. If they're not doing that later, then it's definitely their problem.
So you've GM'd your first game. You think it went pretty good. You've got some criticism for yourself. You got some tips, both from the game, from talking, kind of analyzing it post.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody else is GMing for the first time. Any suggestions for them?
Definitely preparation. The dice are not your friend. They're not the player's friend either, but they're also not yours. There were several situations where, you know, I wanted to, in this particular instance, lead them through a trap door. The characters have to find the trap door, but, you know, they do their observation checks or whatever, and the dice were just not helping me out at all. So I'm just like, how do I get them through this door?
You know, actually, that's probably worth discussing. This was an interesting occurrence, which is pretty rare. But the scenario was that we were in the basement and there was a trap door that was really
kind of a cellar.
It was really the focus of this.
With a birdcage.
Yes, this was. would you go ahead and describe it?
Hey, don't give too many spoilers away.
It was a dark cellar with a birdcage, and there was a bunch of feet on the floor covering a trap door. So, and the observation check was really hard.
And we attempted it several times,
yeah,
and failed every time.
Yes.
Pretty miserably, to the point where there weren't even excess boons, so it was really mechanically preventing us from finding it.
Yes. So at that point, I struggled with either having you guys go up back to the town and like restart the observation process and kind of questioning people, or I could just find some way to like lead you back down into the end of the adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually remember how that resolved. How did we resolve
that? If I recall, somebody made some noise underneath, which
yes.
caused us to investigate that particular spot, which I thought was a great way of handling, drawing our attention to where the door would have been. But that's an interesting hiccup spot. And then I guess my very last question is, being new to the Warhammer world, How did you feel running a game in this setting? Did you feel it was the lack of knowledge or what knowledge you had was sufficient to play with, or did you kind of approach it from a more general perspective?
I think the level of knowledge I had served me well enough, but I think if I had known more, maybe the end of the adventure might not have been so improvised, because once I had everybody down where I wanted them to be, I didn't actually know what was going to happen. So I didn't know the particulars of like how certain creatures fight and the magic that was going on. I think that might have helped me more.
Yeah, I think you picked one of the harder like chaos gods to try to tackle an adventure around. Like Tzeentch is pretty out there.
It got pretty creepy.
You know, to be perfectly honest, the creep factor in the descriptions of what was going on in this ritual far exceeded what was written in the book.
That's good.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing your experience with that. When we come back from our break, we're going to start tackling this mountain of questions, which we are thrilled to have. And we will get through as many as I can. And next episode, we'll tackle a few more. As always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com, on Facebook under Reckless Dice, or hit us up on Twitter at Reckless Dice. Fenderstadt comments, you forgot to give a temporary insanity in one of your sessions. One of the PCs may have been Helga.
Hey, that's me.
Had their willpower distressed by one point during the chaos spawn encounter. And if anybody has not listened to that encounter, it is well worth a listen. It was absolutely amazing. When your willpower is distressed, you pull out the insanities and check the traits. If the trait matches up, in the case of the chaos trait would have, you give the PC the corresponding insanity. If the traits don't match up, the character keeps their wits. Each time the PC takes more stress and you add the stress tokens to the insanity, making it hard to get rid of. When a character's fatigue and willpower is distressed at the same time, that's when they automatically gain an insanity. A new insanity is drawn, even if you had previous ones from taking too much stress, and all the future fatigue and stress tokens accumulate on that, and the character recovers stress below their willpower scores. So, you're absolutely right. I love getting called out on these kind of things where we may have missed an important rule or opportunity to screw our characters over. So, Helga, we might need to retroactively find a way to make you relive that through a dream or something like that.
And thanks, Fenderstadt.
I think Fenderstadt's the one who really engaged your Helga's origin story on the forums.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Hey, thanks for reading.
All right, Lester, you want to take our next question?
Well, as much of a question as that last one was, Martin Takaichi or at Fire Broadside tweets, encumbered limit is your max carrying capacity, but what is the unencumbered limit mentioned on the sheet? Now, can I respond to this? Cause I understand how it works.
Yeah. And Martin was actually, good enough. Him and I talked back a few times about our confusion on this. And then he went back and attempted a very solid clarification, which he outlined for us here. But I think we can all agree the way that it's worded on the character sheets is wildly confusing.
Well, like, you mean just that tiny little blurb at the bottom that says unencumbered limit and encumbered limit?
Yeah, the ones that sound almost exactly the same.
Well, the way I understand it through reading the rules is this, that your unencumbered limit is up to that point, you do not take any penalties. And that point is 5 times your strength score. If you're a dwarf, you get bonuses, but... So if you have a strength 4, then it would be 20. You could carry up to 20 encumbrance, whatever that is. And then for everyone above that, you get to add your strength score on top of that. And that would be your encumbered limit is the max. That is where you can't carry any more than your encumbered limit. So if you had strength 4, your unencumbered limit would be 20 or below. As soon as you go above 20, you are considered encumbered. And your encumbered limit is the maximum amount you can carry. Therefore, in this example, you would have 24. You could have a 24 encumbrance if you could never have more than 24. If you carry 25, you could never move. You couldn't do anything.
Let me jump in there and make a quick correction. You're correct on the unencumbered limit being you suffer no penalties. Everything between your unencumbered limit and your encumbered limit, you suffer one black die for each point that you're in excess. Mm-hmm. Now, once you've exceeded your encumbered limit, you no longer gain your free maneuver in a turn. So you have to start suffering fatigue to get a maneuver, which means if you want to move, you must suffer fatigue.
Okay, so
that becomes a big problem. If you're in combat, you're going to be suffering fatigue, dragging another player out of danger. Generally speaking, you're not going anywhere if you're over your encumbrance limit and trying to travel. But it's really for more shorter-term encounters, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll pass out quick.
But thanks to Martin for helping clarify that, because that's when I had a personal question on and am I getting confused on a lot of this stuff? And if I do, I'm sure other people as well.
Well, most people don't really use encumbrance. I like to because it makes it realistic, but
Makes well, sense. I just don't use it because I didn't understand those stupid terminology. I mean, I understood the concept. It just didn't make enough sense. You know, one thing that was fun over this past 2 weeks is we had made the joke about how to properly use Sigmar's comments, or what are otherwise known as the critical successes. And it was commented that we come up with all these creative ways to use Chaos Stars, but don't really have all these creative ways to do critical successes. And I made the example of somebody climbing a ladder and having to roll and rolling a critical success.
Got pretty good response.
Well, yes, people started. Well, first they jokingly said, "You make people roll when climbing a ladder," and that made me realize how stupid my example was. But following that, they actually gave us some examples of what you could do when rolling a critical success when climbing your ladder. So I think we'll give a couple of those because I found a few of them wildly entertaining. So, you know, maybe when climbing up the ladder, the PC finds a coin pouch dropped by someone. PC gains some money. Hurrah. Or perhaps climbing up the ladder, the PC sees a beautiful maiden through an open window bathing naked. This is just flavoring the story, but the great view might inspire the PC with one or two fortune dice in his next roll.
I love that one. I love that one.
That was the best.
That's a great one.
Oh, climbing up the ladder, the PC notices graffiti on the wall that could be story flavor, like number two, dirty joke, or could be a clue or a hint to the adventure they're on. So, you know, as silly as those were actually some funny and creative ways to use it. I really do like the idea of throwing in fortune dice or inspiring the character. Somebody else offered the option to give the character maybe the inspired condition or something where they have more long-term benefits over several turns. I also like the idea of dropping a clue that might allow the story to progress a little further or quicker if they're having trouble.
Yeah, I really like the idea of using the conditions just because that's just another way of, you know, getting use out of those.
But I think it's safe to say we're just going to use the naked woman almost every time now, right?
Well, not every time, but you'll definitely see it. If we ever play a game, you will see the naked woman.
What about the female PCs? What do I get? What's my inspiration?
I don't know. You're not inspired by naked women?
They're certainly aesthetic, but...
Exactly. They're aesthetically pleasing.
But Helga likes a man.
Okay.
So what kind of man is Helga looking for?
Or a goat. I was just going to say.
So yeah, you see a goat, you know.
A beefy man.
A beefy man.
A capable man.
A hardened Kislevian man.
Yes, a burly Kislevian muscle man.
bending tattoos, iron with his face.
With his face, yes.
So, New Zombie comments, with regards to the Sigmar's comments, he also mentions fortune cards, fortune dice, and anything that the players are able to implement both immediately or later on in the session. So perhaps maybe somebody comes to the rescue, or someone trips and falls that allows the story to progress a little further. Dawn, oh, I'm sorry, Lester, did you have a comment?
Oh, I was just going to say, I was just going to read the next one, but go ahead, man.
Go for it, dude.
Our friend Don says on September
16th. Friend of the show?
Yeah, on September 16th, 2011 at 12:27 p.m. He says, thanks. Also, I would love it if you guys cover the technology of the world. Mm-hmm. I know there are some guns and printing presses. Are there any other major technology a fledgling Woofrup GM should know about?
That's a great question.
I agree.
I was really excited to include this one in this show because the Warhammer world is not a typical technological medieval world.
No, it's magic.
Very similar, but it does have a little bit of nuances to it.
Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of magic and cool things. The Skaven are great with technology too, but I do agree. I think we should do, we should almost do a whole session or at least a section of one of the sessions.
Okay.
No compasses, apparently.
Yeah, we did have this discussion on compasses.
Yeah.
Are there compasses?
Kind of. There's like sextants and things like that, other navigational tools. There may be compasses, but I doubt
they're called what now?
Well, sextant.
A sextant is a very...
Is this exciting, Helga?
I'm just making sure I heard correctly.
This is what inspires Helga. When she rolls a Sigmar's comment, yeah, I'm going to throw a sextant at her.
I just have to tell you that there are no sextants in Kislev because they are not
very
they're not very good at they're not good at navigating the oceans and things like that. But anyway, Dawn,
I bet I've seen a few sextants.
Well, sextants, yes, but sextants, no. Don continues in saying he saw in Liber Fanatic 8 where Sean Connors made a reference to a hot air balloon. So in the adventure, there is a hot air balloon.
Yeah, I know the one. Actually, there's another adventure that had a hot air balloon in, oh gosh, I don't know if it was second or third edition, but...
I always thought it was Dark Elves. I'm gonna
talk a little bit about the tech now and then kind of save the bulk of it for maybe another main topic, because I think there's enough content there to really warrant a deep dive.
Oh, there's lots of content.
I mean, the basics are there is gunpowder.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that would kind of go along with kind of primitive gunpowder is in place. So,
you're talking smoothbore guns with probably barrel-loaded flintlock kind of things. Even
absolutely. Cannons, mortars.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Where the dwarves
tanks
have a little bit different. There's also a lot of steam power in the Empire.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's the steam tank, which is present in the tabletop game.
Yeah, it was kind of cop from dwarven technology, because dwarves are probably the most technologically advanced of the order races.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, they use a lot of steam and smoke powered devices that really get pretty creative. I'm not even sure I know how to generalize them, but some of the more obscure ones, they do have flamethrowers. Organ guns, which is kind of almost like a primitive machine gun. They have a fantastical helicopter.
Gyrocopter, yeah.
Gyrocopter, yep, you got it.
They have tools for drilling, too, like for drilling underground.
They probably spend equally as much time inventing contraptions to brew beer as they do to fight goblins.
Well, yeah.
The hot air balloon option is definitely available. But again, all of these technologies are going to be very, very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are commonplace. Now, the printing press, which you brought up, is an interesting one, because the printing press is becoming more and more widespread and available.
Hence the agitator.
The printed word is really a new thing that's allowing a lot of people to get ideas across the Empire quickly. Historically, it had always been done through priests who were reading old books.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the only one that would be widely exposed to the average guy running down the street, I think.
But the average guy running down the street can't read. They're correct. Starting to be able to read, but
many printing presses would generate documents that have perhaps pictures, or you might have a town crier screaming out its contents, or someone might take it to a scribe.
Yeah, well, I mean, essentially, you're looking at the 15th century. The late 15th century is basically when it's set in Germany. So you've got the printing press, yeah, but not very many people make use of it. It's usually the gold tier. But anyway, he kind of finishes off here and asks if we would do a Fantasy Grounds adventure by recording the audio and video so that he could see us playing.
I'm ashamed to say we've tried it twice and failed. The adventure worked fine. We got the audio fine, but the video failed both times. I think we just tried to bite off a little more than we can chew, and our video file became corrupt during the rendering process of both attempts. So what we're going to do in our next Fantasy Grounds session is actually just record a snippet of it to give you guys a sense of how it works, and I think that will be much more tolerable on our hardware.
Yeah.
And I have a pretty powerful machine, but for whatever reason, I think it was just too much to handle.
Well, and we're also currently in talks about trying to set it up so we can run some games for the listeners out there to take part in. So it might be a few months before we actually get that off the ground, but we welcome anybody to come play if we do get that going.
Cool. Well, Lari Mayala, who's another friend of the show, this will be our last question. He writes in, he finds it interesting that people really like the Bright Wizards the most. One more use for that Burning House location card. With them, you get this kind of what you see is what you get. But with most of the other orders, it's a little more clouded and not so direct. So he wonders, could this mean that the orders are a bit too clumsy, or the orders are a bit of a clumsy way to present the idea to players? He realizes that fireball throwing wizards have their own allure about them, but we seem to, we are poking fun at the Amethyst wizard, poking at a corpse, actually.
I would love to see that.
Well, I guess what he's getting at here is that the Warhammer orders and the orders of magic and the colleges are really pretty convoluted, especially if you're thinking on more traditional wizards in other role-playing games where they might be elementalists like a water wizard, fire wizard, and so forth. Here we have a jade wizard. Well, what the heck's a jade wizard? I don't know. I mean, I get the fire wizard. He's simple. But everybody else is a who knows what.
Yeah, but that's kind of the appeal.
How do you feel about that?
I think that's the appeal, though. The whole idea of a wizard is that they're all like esoteric and strange. And I mean, if you're going to play a wizard, you're going to have to, if you're going to accurately portray a wizard in a game of Wolfrup, you should do some research.
Can we not call it that?
I know. I do. That's why I say it with such a snide, like, I kind of tilt my nose in the air and go Wolfrup when I say that because it bothers me. But I mean, it's the fastest way to say it. And I've had a few Sam Adams. So anyway, I personally think that. A wizard is extremely esoteric, and you need to do a little research. And I mean, really all it takes is a little bit of reading to understand where these different colleges come from. None of them are too none of them are too strange to me. They all have a pretty direct, place in the world. You've got your celestial wizards who are essentially diviners. They are like your tarot card reading future seers, right? And you've got your amethyst wizards who are essentially necromancers, but they're good. Ooh. Good necklace.
Layla, you just read all the content on the different colleges and what it means to be a wizard. What was your take on that?
I thought they were all pretty, just like Lester was saying, they all have their own kind of role to fill. I didn't think they were particularly fluffy or anything like that. I do think that they have more action cards, right? So you kind of have to remember what you're doing. Maybe that's why nobody plays them. I'm just looking at the latter half of his question.
Well, I find looking at the orders, the eight orders, and if I want to play a wizard and I'm relatively new to Warhammer, or even not so much, I look at these orders and say, okay, I can be a jade wizard, a light wizard, a gold wizard, an amethyst wizard. And after reading those, I still have no idea what any of those do. Like, just the word of their order is not descriptive enough to really engage me. Now, granted, I can go in there now and read what each of those are and read a page on each one and decide which one I want to go through. But that's eight pages of reading, and
I still
have to figure out what to do with them. Not a big deal.
But it's a wizard. That's like the whole point. Like, that's what wizards do. They research things and they like read stuff, and it takes a lot of effort to be a wizard. So it makes sense.
So my new character is an amethyst wizard, and I chose an amethyst wizard for this exact purpose of what Laurie's bringing up here is I really did not have a strong handle on what all the colleges did. And I felt compelled that I really should know. So I went in and chose to be a college that was something that I was not already comfortable with. I knew a few of them, but this was one I didn't know, and that's why I chose to be that character. Now, I really just kind of picked it at random initially and then kind of learned to like it afterwards. But for somebody who's really not so frilly or, kind of throw it to the wind and see what happens, I kind of find it difficult for people. I mean, well, Lester, how many times have you played with a gold wizard?
How many times have I played with a gold wizard? Well, I don't like to play with wizards personally, but no, never mind. But it's sweet though. And I would personally love to play a gold wizard, an alchemist. Like, this is classic.
I guess what I'm getting at is how uncommon are things other than bright wizards?
Well, but how
very uncommon?
Okay. Well, but how common is a priest of let's
say, same point. Okay. I think this can be taken both ways. I think this applies very directly to the priests and the colleges.
Exactly.
You'll see priests of Sigmar, maybe Shalya, maybe more, everybody else. That's pretty esoteric.
That's why they picked those three. They picked the three most common ones for the core set because for that reason, sure. I believe. I mean, I don't think it's that far-fetched, and I think people who want to explore have a very... There's a lot of breadth and depth there, and it's actually very awesome to go in and experience and learn about all these different colleges and all these different sects or cults. But, you know, once again, if you don't really want to, you know, put the time into it or whatever, and that's not something, if you want to have something more direct, well, be a thief or, you know, be a skull smashing warrior or something like that.
Well, and maybe this says a lot about the personality types who play this game, because maybe you don't have a lot of people who are interested in poking at dead people. Yeah. Maybe you don't have people who identify with nature-loving wood freaks. So
yeah, tree huggers. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
My amethyst wizard, the first time he sees a dead corpse where he's not being chased by a demon, is going to stop and poke it.
Oh, I sincerely hope he does.
Now, are you going to poke it with a stick?
That will be left to be seen. So with that, we'll wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Be sure to comment on the site, recklessdice.com, or shoot us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Reckless Dice. Till next time, guys, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for Gargoyle and guys.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.